This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Mental Health Awareness Month has been observed since 1949, every May. And this year, KACU's Josiah Wannell is taking a closer look at one of the most fraught intersections in public life, mental illness and the criminal justice system, with a series entitled Minds on Trial. In episode 2, we heard how Texas built its framework, the specialty courts, the legislation, the teams, but that architecture didn't emerge from nowhere. Episode 3, entitled The Miami Model, traced it back to the courthouse where the blueprint was first drawn.
Judge Steve Lifeman spent 3 decades on the bench in Miami-Dade County. He did not set out to become one of the most referenced names in American mental health justice reform. He set out to fix a problem in front of him. And what he built has since drawn researchers, legislators, police chiefs, and advocates from across the country, all traveling to South Florida to study what is now called the Miami Model. The foundation of that model is not a court. It is not a piece of legislation.
Crisis Intervention Team Police Program. It's a 40-hour training program that teaches law enforcement how to identify individuals in crisis, how to de-escalate the situation, and where to take them once you successfully de-escalate the situation rather than arresting them.
That program, Crisis Intervention Team Training, or CIT, operates on a straightforward premise. The officer's role in a mental health call is not to impose order, but to restore safety. The distinction matters enormously in practice. Miami did not ask officers to stop responding to these calls, but it trained them to respond differently, and it did so at scale.
We now have the largest trained squad of CIT officers in the United States. We have over 9,500 officers trained. They do absolutely amazing work.
Claims about program effectiveness are common in criminal justice reform. The results reframe what becomes possible when law enforcement and clinical response are aligned.
The number of arrests in Dade County went from 118,000 a year to 53,000. Our jail audit went from 7,400 to 4,400, and our police shootings almost stopped.
That final data point, the reduction in police shootings, opens a dimension of the Miami model that is rarely part of the public conversation about mental health reform. It demands a candid look at what officers themselves are carrying into these calls.
In fact, between 15 and 35% of police officers have very severe PTSD. And so we set up a treatment program for police officers outside their departments so that they would be comfortable getting treated. And you have to understand that last year and the year before that and the year before that and so on, more police officers died from suicide than in the line of duty.
In recognition of that reality, Miami built a confidential treatment program for officers outside their departments, a place where they could receive care without professional consequence. The effect on use of force outcomes proved measurable. When the city commissioned an analysis of police shootings before and after the program launched, the data told a clear story.
The city of Miami did an analysis for us, and they looked at the number of police shootings the 5 years before we started CIT, and there were 90, which is a lot. That's one police department. And over the next 15, 20 years, it was down to like 12 or 13.
Lifeman attributes that reduction not only to better tactical training, but to the mental health of the officers themselves.
I think PTSD among law enforcement also plays a significant role, maybe a larger role. And it turns out that when we get officers treated and they don't panic when they're in a situation where they may get scared, they're less likely to pull a trigger than not if they're doing emotionally better. So everybody wins there when you do that.
The financial implications of that shift were eventually recognized beyond law enforcement. When Miami's mayor presented the city's bond rating for review, the reviewer set aside the economic development data and focused on one single question. How had the city reduced its police shootings so significantly? Lower shootings meant fewer settlements. Fewer settlements meant lower fiscal risk.
they were actually able to get their bond rating improved because they significantly reduced their police shootings. And the only thing that really had changed during that period was CIT.
Narrow the lens further to just the 1,000 individuals in that population who had been arrested 5 or more times. The numbers don't get smaller. They get more alarming.
Those 1,000 people spent 317,000 days in the Dade County Jail over 5 years. They cost taxpayers over $117 million. And we got nothing for it.
The phrase bears repeating, not as rhetoric, but as a policy reality. Releasing someone from custody without a treatment plan does not resolve a crisis. It defers it. The person returns, the call goes out again. The cycle continues at public expense. Lifeman places that reality alongside a medical analogy that strips away any pretense of logic from the current approach.
We wouldn't treat people with cancer or heart disease the way we treat people with mental illnesses. I don't know why there's a difference. They're both organs. They're both getting damaged. If someone has a heart attack on the side of the street, we're not going to walk over them and pretend it didn't happen. We're going to call 911. An EMT is going to get sent to the scene. They're going to get the best possible care. They may be unconscious. They'll be taken to a hospital. If they need emergency surgery, they're going to get involuntary treatment against their will. No one's asked. But then they're going to have a really good shot at having a full and happy life. And insurance is most likely going to cover their cost. But God forbid you have a heart attack of the brain where you have a psychotic disorder. We're kind of scared of you. We're going to let you hang out on the street and watch your brain deficits increase by allowing your gray matter to get destroyed over a decade.
The post-arrest diversion track within the Miami model was designed to interrupt exactly that trajectory. When individuals identified in the jail as having serious mental illness were transferred to crisis stabilization within 72 hours rather than waiting months for trial, the outcomes were sufficient to change the position of the state attorney's office.
Recidivism dropped from about 75 to 20%. And the state attorney agreed to try it with nonviolent felony cases. Recidivism went from 75% to 6%.
Those numbers, sustained over time, eventually justified something that would have seemed implausible at the program's outset.
And you reduce your jail audit from 74 to 4,400, you actually are able to close the jail, which for us so far has saved Dade County about $239 million in actual savings.
It is a result that tends to silence the argument that reform is too expensive to attempt. Lifeman's summary of the model is characteristically direct.
So we know treatment works. We know that the faster we get people treated, the better outcomes we're going to get. And when you do this whole approach, everybody wins. You know, I think there's really three reasons. I think one is it improves public safety. Two, it saves critical tax dollars. And three, it gives people who are just sick an opportunity to have a life of hope and opportunity. And there's really no reason not to do it because the way we do it now is expensive. It doesn't work. It makes things worse. And it frustrates the heck out of everybody.
That is the conclusion Miami reached after 25 years of data. It is the conclusion Texas is reaching through its own experience. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
The Miami model proved something that skeptics had long doubted, that the system could be redesigned, and that when it was, lives were changed. But policy and programs can only reach the people who interact with them. Episode 4 of Minds on Trial goes somewhere the data can't. Inside one family's experience from the very beginning. The episode entitled The Inside airs next Wednesday at noon on the West Texas Dispatch. Previous episodes are available on demand at kacu.org. Early voting for the Texas primary runoff election begins in less than a week. In these runoffs, voters will make final decisions on who'll represent their party on the ballot in November. It'll be the first general election since Texas' controversial mid-decade redistricting, which redrew the state's congressional map. The Texas Newsroom's Blaze Ganey has a look at the matchup for the Republicans facing off to be the Republican candidate on the ballot for the 19th Congressional District.
A noteworthy runoff is for the Republican nomination in Texas' 19th Congressional District, which spans from Lubbock to Abilene. There, pro-Trump Republicans are facing off, Tom Sell and Abraham Enriquez.
I really love and appreciate President Trump.
President Trump is rightfully evening out the playing field as it pertains to trade.
Hamill of UNT says that admiration's expected since they're both first-time candidates for office.
People who don't have backgrounds in politics, they're still trying to demonstrate that they're going to be the most pro-Trump.
So there isn't much difference between their ideas on policy. Take immigration, for instance. Here's Sell.
Deporting those, you know, the bad hombres, the dangerous illegals, the felons who were able to come across the border, is a noble goal.
And Enriquez.
Let's recodify the border policies that President Trump has enacted.
In a deep red district like this, Hamill says it's a winning strategy.
For most of these, it's a 60%, 80% Republican seat. And so really, if you win the primary, you won the election.
That's actually the case for the majority of Texas congressional districts, including the ones we just talked about. That means for many voters, their party's primary runoff is essentially the election that'll decide who their representative is in Washington, making it all the more important to vote. I'm Blaze Ganey in Austin.
Welcome back to the West Texas Dispatch. It used to be called Lincoln Middle School. Many of us remember the campus on South First, but before that, for many, it was Abilene High. Just a few days, though, it's going to reopen as Abilene Heritage Square. We could call it the public library, a great event space. I heard someone say it will be Abilene's living room. But one correct way to describe it would be the biggest cultural addition to Abilene in decades. Joining us now is Laura Moore. She's the executive director of the Grace Museum and Heritage Square. She is busy right now. Laura, thank you for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
My goodness gracious. Let's go back. Let's take a step back and tell us about how this started, where we are right now, because it seems like we've been hearing about this for a long time.
Yes. Well, about 16 years ago, there was a group of us that realized the importance of library and that it was difficult to pass a bond for a new main library. And it's just the great equalizer of people. You know, Carnegie came and built a library here and across our nation. And so we wanted to just honor that process and to look at a way to bring to our community a new main library. And at the same time, there was this dilapidated lot, so to speak, acre, that had a lot of history. You know, since the beginning of our community, there has been a school there. This is actually the third main school, but there was an elementary school there as well, right on the railroad tracks, so that everyone would know we valued education. And so it just seemed like something worth pursuing.
And a David Castle building.
Absolutely.
Like so many in downtown Abilene.
Yes.
All right. Well, what is Heritage Square? Because I think that's the big question.
I understand
the hardest thing to describe. What is it?
Well, I think first and foremost, it was and is the new main library. A new main library with all the bells and whistles, all the comforts of home, so to speak, in terms of places to sit and be, a podcast studio, a makerspace, dedicated areas for children of all ages and adults. But then there were other buildings on the lot. And so, you know, we began to think, what should it be? So on the first floor of the historic space, it is still Abilene. It is still library space. Predominantly back of house, but genealogy is in that area as well. And then that feeds into three new constructed floors of library space. The old gymnasium, Hoosier's Gym, 1940s, is an event space. Seats about 375 on the main gym floor, has a new gym floor that is conducive to dancing. All back of house, amenities like a green room and a kitchen, and then all of those bleachers. And so it's beautiful space that's been brought home, been brought back. Then the old girls' gym, 1970s, not too impressive, just there to house the girls, is now a science center. And the Grace Museum is art and history, and now it is science. It is STEAM related. It has over 130 interactives. Our director, Marcia Hammack, went across Texas and looked and beyond at other very successful science centers and sat and watched the things that people came back to time and again. And that's what we fundraise to include. And it's outdoor space as well.
There are going to be a lot of moving parts. It is a big building.
Yes.
There's going to be a lot of people inside.
Uh-huh.
Are you ready? Is the staff ready?
Yes. I mean, I don't know that. How could you be ready?
Correct.
It's a large, large project, if anybody's curious. And we have stayed the course through the pandemic and raised a lot of money. You know, it is privately funded on the construction side, $77 million. And so that has been quite the tax. And then, of course, standing up something like that has lots of moving pieces. But I would say we are as ready as we're going to be. And then we will continue to address anything needed.
I would imagine this is going to be something that you open and you find out.
Yeah,
what is the most
absolutely.
Popular area? Where
yes.
are people going?
Yes.
How many people show up?
Yes.
You're going to have to be kind of fluid about operations,
I would
think.
And I think that's our intent and our comfort zone. And we are ready. And, you know, we think of it as a community living room. And we are ready for the community to come.
Well, that kind of answered my next question, which is, what do you think this is going to mean to the community? What is this space going to be for them?
Well, it is their space. You know, it is the cornerstone of history. It is, you know, played into many people's lives or their parents' lives or grandparents. And I think in today, it is honoring an opportunity to learn, to gain knowledge, to find community in the library. And I think the Science Center serves about a 62-county region of children who will come and have that component in life. And I just think it's wonderful to light up again that acre of land on the railroad track and say, we value education.
Remember you driving down Grape from the north side?
Yes.
You'd be going down that hill. And back when Lincoln Abilene High was open, you could see it lit for miles and miles.
Yes.
I mean, it was a dominant structure for Abilene, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's returned to its glory. And you almost feel the buildings waking up and beginning a new life.
If I want to be a part of what's going on this weekend and be there for the opening, what am I going to see? What do I need to do to make sure that I'm there?
Okay, absolutely. We welcome everyone. 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, we'll have our ribbon cutting on the front lawn. I encourage you to come and be a part of that. And immediately following that, we will open the library and the floodgates will come open, so to speak. And the Science Center is free that day. And there are two opportunities to gain admission because it's quite possible we'll have a very large crowd. We'll take the crowds through the Science Center in 45-minute segments of 200 people. There are bands available to reserve online for each hour for 100 of those spots, and then 100 will remain open to the public. And we just look forward to everyone coming.
All right. I'm going to ask you some hard questions.
Okay.
And if you don't have the answers, that's okay.
All right.
Do you have some numbers? How many people total do you think worked on the project? You have any idea?
Gosh.
And it's okay if you don't know. But I was just thinking this might be something that you guys had, you know, in your back pocket.
Sure. Well, not in my back pocket, George. I can't claim that. I mean, you know, probably 50 to 60 directly volunteers worked on the project.
Wow.
You know, we had a legacy committee that collected all the things that we now have on display in the cases in Lincoln again, telling that story. We did lots and lots of videos of people who had life there, which we will be sharing. And then we had a lot of people who just put their nose to the grind and said, let's do it. And now, of course, we've joined hands with a lot of paid vendors, but many of which have really put their heart into it.
Yeah. Everybody involved, I would think.
Yes.
My goodness gracious. It has been a ball to watch it go up.
Yeah.
It was up already, but to see it change.
Yeah. And there is, you know, a portion that did go up in the alcove where David Castle had intended to add another wing, but then we had a war. And so that's where we added the new construction.
Love it. Laura Moore, again, Executive Director of the Grace Museum, as well as Abilene Heritage Square. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let me, on behalf of everybody at the West Texas Dispatch, offer you a giant congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
16 years work. We should have a sound effect right now for clapping.
No.
Thank you so much. Abilene's legacy of restoring treasured buildings, protecting them for the future, continues with Abilene Heritage Square, set to open Saturday, 10 a.m., at 1699 South First Street. This is the West Texas Dispatch. As the price of oil rises, so does the problem of oil rustling. That is the theft of crude oil, a crime that has been part of the Texas oil patch since the earliest days of wildcatters. But today, officials say oil field theft has grown into something far more organized, more dangerous, and more costly. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports.
In March of 2025, an oil pipeline exploded in the night sky over Reeves County in West Texas. Investigators said it was the result of oil thieves trying to tap into a pressurized pipeline.
They cut into the pipeline and tried to tap directly into the main pipeline.
That's Tim Murphy with the Texas Department of Public Safety, testifying recently before the Texas House Energy Resources Committee.
It sparked and it blew. They blew up everything in the area, but the pipeline burned for several days.
Murphy said this was an example of oil field theft that went horribly wrong, but it could have been much worse. The massive fire was contained before it reached a more populated area. Officials say the incident shows how oil field theft has become more than a property crime. It is a serious threat to workers, nearby communities, and critical energy infrastructure. And in West Texas, virtually anywhere you look is critical energy infrastructure. The Permian Basin provides about half of the nation's oil. The vast, flat, dusty landscape is populated with pump jacks, oil storage tanks, and drilling pads. Each one is a tempting target for a thief.
It's like any other commodity. When the price is high, they just get sexier.
That's Jim Wright, chairman of the Texas Railroad Commission, the state agency that oversees oil and gas production. Wright says the thieves are often sophisticated.
They're cloning these trucks. They can take a truck, get a full load of oil, and not be noticed.
Wright says criminals paint tanker trucks to look like legitimate oil field service vehicles.
So as they go through these remote ranches to get access to that oil, they go unnoticed.
The stolen crude is sold through a broker who sells it onto the market. He says the theft is happening across Texas.
About 40% of the industry has experienced some sort of theft. And so I've heard that number could be as high as $1 billion on an annual basis.
Wright says the problem is growing, and recent criminal cases show the scale. In April, federal prosecutors announced that 14 people from Texas and New Mexico had been indicted in an alleged crude oil theft conspiracy. The indictment alleges crude oil was siphoned from producers in southeastern New Mexico and then transported across state lines into Texas for resale. Sheriff Stan Parker of Howard County in West Texas says he doesn't have the manpower to deal with the problem.
Our county alone gets probably over 1,000, 1,500 barrels of oil reported stolen every month.
Parker says the oil thieves know the oil drilling business, and law enforcement does not.
Our problem is we don't know who's supposed to be there and who's not. And the thing about it is if I pulled up on a tank battery right now, I don't know if you can be there or you not. I don't know if you're drawing water off of it. I don't know if you're pulling oil. It's got very complicated.
Texas lawmakers have responded by creating an organized oil field theft prevention unit within the Department of Public Safety, which is now training local sheriffs what to look for to spot an oil thief. The legislature also created the Stop Theft Task Force to study petroleum theft, gaps in the law, and long-term economic impacts. The task force will report its findings to state lawmakers in December. Texas has recently increased the criminal penalty for oil field theft, depending on the value of what was stolen. A conviction can carry 2 to 10 years or up to life in prison. I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
Texas Tech University students and faculty held a mock funeral last week for academic freedom outside of the system's Board of Regents meeting. It protests the system's course content review process and systematic phase-out of programs centered on sexual orientation or gender identity. KTTC reporter Brad Burt has more.
System Chancellor Brandon Creighton, who initiated the curriculum review with a memorandum issued in December and phase-out procedures with a memorandum issued in April, told the Board of Regents that out of more than 14,000 courses reviewed system-wide, less than 2% resulted in any recommended modifications.
More importantly, this effort showed the Texas Tech University system is helping define what compliance and accountability look like for the state and the nation, through a decisive approach that reinforces academic integrity, but also ensures our students earn degrees of the highest value that prepare them for the future in this quickly evolving workforce.
Creighton has cited Senate Bill 37, which he authored while serving as a state senator for the Houston area and passed by the Texas legislature last year. The bill shifted the authority on curriculum away from localized councils of faculty members who teach those subjects and toward the governor-appointed Board of Regents, while creating a state-level committee to recommend courses that should be required for graduation. While Creighton says the new course requirements better prepare students for the workforce, some faculty and students disagree. The Board of Regents allowed Honors College student Aaron Texidor to speak in the meeting. He spoke favorably of a new Master's of Education program with a major in school counseling that was proposed in Thursday's meeting, but he also expressed some concern.
The story that I've been hearing, specifically in the Psychology and Education Department, has been a story of fear. These teachers, people who have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowledge, are afraid to share it. They're worried that through Senate Bill 37, their classes, their jobs, and their livelihood will be at risk simply for speaking on peer-reviewed scientific fact.
Texidor says the prohibition of certain topics that are taught and accepted by experts and professionals in those fields can negatively affect the credibility of student degrees from Texas Tech, and the issue has already led instructors to self-censor out of fear of backlash.
This new push to change your education for the sake of workforce preparedness puts us at risk of losing accreditation from national boards, having an inverse effect. Now, you might be wondering why I'm speaking about this instead of them. I believe it's simple. They are scared.
Outside the board meeting, students and faculty are not afraid of speaking. A horse-drawn funeral carriage carries an urn and stacks of books as protesters, dressed as mourners, hold signs accusing university administration of academic censorship. James Snoddy is the founder of Raiders Against Censorship, a student organization formed in reaction to the memorandums from Chancellor Creighton's office and a planner of Thursday's protest. Snoddy says one primary challenge has been making students aware of the changes.
Because a lot of the problems we have here is that students don't know what's going on. But once we explain it to them, they're staunchly against everything. And I mean, the most recent memorandum on April 9th was not sent to students. I had to get it leaked from a professor to send to everyone, and we printed it out for a bunch of students to read.
One place where Snoddy and Creighton may agree is that this discussion isn't limited to Texas Tech University and won't be ending with this semester.
It's just a precedent being set to go further, because like they said in their first memorandum, this is only the first step.
The April 9th memorandum further requires Texas Tech provosts to review and identify degree programs and certificates that cover course content, quote, centered on sexual orientation and gender identity, and submit finalized reports to the chancellor's office by June 15th. I'm Brad Burt in Lubbock.
It's time for West Texas Roots. In today's day and age, rebellious students are punished by detention or, in some cases, suspension. But this hasn't always been the case, especially in one-room schoolrooms in West Texas. Randy Robinette tells the story of how his father witnessed a group of older boys terrorizing their one-room schoolhouse and how they even made several teachers quit. This all changed when the new teacher's patience wore thin and he asked the trio to pick out a mesquite switch. Needless to say, the trio ceased their mischief and the teacher kept his job.
Jim was just talking about one-room schools. Reminded me of my dad's story. His name was Sherman. Sherman Robinette, and he grew up in, I'm trying to remember where this would have been. It was in West Texas, east of Lubbock, probably around Calgary, Spur, and it was a one-room school. Several kids there, maybe 10 or 15, but they couldn't keep a teacher because there were some teenage boys that went to school that didn't want to be there, and they would literally run off whatever teacher they hired. My dad's dad was on the school board, so he was in charge of trying to help hire somebody. They literally ran off one lady that came to teach. Dad said the story was she gave a speech and said, we can all be nice and get along, or if you decide you don't want to get along, I can turn into a lemon and be pretty mean. And one of the boys said, let's make her into a lemon and squeeze her. She didn't last very long. Another man came along and assured my grandpa that he could handle the kids. He started, I guess it was at the beginning of the year, at some point, the teenage boys started acting up again. I think there was maybe three of them. The teacher put up with it for as long as he could. Finally said, okay, boys, we're going to have to give you a whipping. And they laughed. There's three of them and one teacher. And he said, y'all go cut me a mesquite switch. And Dad said, they came back in dragging about half a tree, a stump about big as your forearm. And teacher said, well, you probably ought to trim some of the branches off of that before we do this. And he said, they brought back in what amounted to a club. And the teacher dismissed the rest of the kids that all ran outside and ran around to listen to see what was happening. And Dad said it sounded like a man beating a canvas tent. And he said that teacher lasted a while. That wouldn't happen nowadays. Nothing close to that. The words would get you in trouble, wouldn't they?
We recorded Randy Robinette's story of how his father's schoolmates were disciplined in a one-room school at the Taylor County Expo Center. This is the West Texas Dispatch. Sonic Ranch is a world-class residential recording studio in Tornillo, Texas. That's just east of El Paso. The studio has attracted well-known artists from the U.S., Mexico, and beyond with top-notch equipment, vintage instruments, and a relaxed setting on a working pecan farm. Alita Moello wrote about Sonic Ranch for Puentes News Collaborative, and she talks to KTEP's Angela Kacherga about the recording studio.
So when you get to Sonic Ranch, I mean, you see the rows of the pecan orchards, of course, and then it's a really pretty, like, rustic wooden sign that says Sonic Ranch on it, and I think that really gives the studio its feel. You can kind of already tell the vibe of it just from seeing the outside. It's a really big Spanish hacienda. It's kind of in a horseshoe shape, and all of the studios and the rooms are located throughout there. There's a kitchen. It's surrounded by, like I said, the pecan orchards, but there's a ton of plants and trees around also. There's the cats, which I mentioned in the story as well.
Well, tell us about the cats.
So there's a few cats. I think they got two more since I initially went out there. But they're stray cats that they've kind of adopted, and they feed them, and the cats roam into the studios too while artists record. And they're all really sweet. It's a really cool place, just the environment. The
artists come from all over. These aren't just local artists. There are some people who get their start there, and there's other big-name people. Give us a sense of who's there.
So a really big one that a lot of people do know about is Beach House, and they're a little bit more alternative. But Beach House has been recording there for over 10 years now. When I was there, Strawberry Guy was also recording there, and he's another alternative artist. But, you know, there's others, like, and I think for people around my generation, too, like Faye Webster is another big one. So I think the cool thing, too, is you get to see all kinds of genres. So you have a lot of alternative and indie, and then you have some rock. And like you said, Zoe recorded there, too, which is another big one. So They have a ton of variety.
Yeah, I've been really, I remember hearing when Zoya was out there recording, and that turned out to be a huge album. I'm a huge fan, and they've come to El Paso. They've returned multiple times and really to sell at concerts. So they're one. And so it's been fascinating to see, you know, really people from both sides of the border across the U.S. and outside the country have come here. What do you think, and you talk about that in your story, brings people not just the remote location, but the setup, the instruments?
Mm-hmm. So they have a ton of vintage instruments. They have a soundboard that was, it's a huge soundboard, but it was combined, it's two separate soundboards, and one of them was from a really popular rock band. And somehow they wired the two together to make one giant soundboard, and that was really cool to see. But they also have a lot of vintage gear as well that they said a lot of artists go there for that gear, and it's gear that they've wanted to use since they were younger. And so, you know, it's cool that they can provide that to them.
So, and finally, it really is a creative space, a haven, because they are isolated. But also, if there are other artists there, they can come together, really mix and talk and in this beautiful natural setting.
Well, there's a huge kitchen and then a large dining room with like a really long dining room table. And when we were given a tour of the studio, one thing that they told us was that they have enough rooms to accommodate several artists at one time. And so this means that in the morning, the staff will make breakfast and everyone comes together and they'll all talk over breakfast or they'll talk over dinner. So I think that's really unique also because in most places, you know, everyone would be kind of isolated on their own, working on their own projects. But in this way, it's really collaborative, not just in the music sense, but they all get to know each other, which is really cool. And also, like you said, these artists come from around the world. So they may not have met anywhere else except for Sonic Ranch. And so I think that's really cool.
One of the cats at Sonic Ranch, Squeaker, who died last year, is featured on Future Bird's album cover for their new release, Deluxe Company. A creative studio in Lubbock has launched a new live music series called Tinier Desk. It's inspired by NPR's popular Tiny Desk concerts. The series invites local artists to perform stripped-down sets behind an office desk. KTTZ's Mariah Shepherd spoke with co-owner Caleb Wiley about the new series.
Jackalope Creative co-owner Caleb Wiley says the idea came naturally after years of working in Lubbock's music scene.
It just kind of felt like a no-brainer as soon as we had the space to do it.
Wiley says the goal is to create more opportunities for local and growing artists.
There's a lot of these bands in town that like people want to see, so just want to see more opportunities for people in a different venue.
Unlike traditional concert spaces, Tinier Desk offers a smaller, more relaxing setting. Wiley says this space is something that fills a gap in Lubbock's live music scene. The stripped-down format also puts these artists to the test.
I think it's fun to like kind of strip a song back to its like core elements and just really get to like evaluate the song and the structure and the writing without the production.
And while that can be intimidating, Wiley says it highlights what truly makes an artist stand out.
Right, like there's a vulnerability of like, oh, like I don't have a crazy effects rig and a stereo amp set up and all of these things. Like now it really is just like, here is the song, the melody, the chord structures, the lyrics, like a little bit exposed.
The series has already created meaningful moments for local performers. And even beyond the live shows, the team is working to increase production by recording performances to reach an even wider audience.
I would love it if that like kind of takes on a second life of like people wanting to find and watch those shows after the fact.
But at its core, Tinier Desk is about supporting local artists and building a community through music.
So, you know, I mean, we're seeing all these artists and like, I want them to thrive. I want them to do well. And if we can do something that helps with that, you know, then great.
You can find tickets to see upcoming shows at thejackalopecreative.com. For KTTZ, I'm Mia Shepherd.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. We want you to be too. Tune in. Keep up with the West Texas Dispatch through the podcast. They're available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from executive producer Heather Claiborne, who was assisted by producers Shayla Conley and Caleb Leger. Our digital editor is Calvin Claiborne. JC Gamble wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.